All right, welcome to another deep dive with us. If you're here, I think it's safe to say that you like to understand things deeply, but efficiently. And today we're going to try to tackle something that can feel both like really foundational to the faith, but also kind of a lot. We're going to talk about God as lawgiver in the Old Testament, and we've got this like really interesting theological lecture as our source material, and our mission here is pretty straightforward. We want to just get those crucial insights out about what this law was even all about. Why did it matter way back then? And then what does it mean? What doesn't it mean for you and me today? We're not going to go into like crazy detail. We're just going to try to hit those big important things that you really need to know.
I love it. And you're exactly right. I mean, I think so often when we come to the Old Testament law, there's a sense of like, oh man, this is a lot. Like, how do I even approach this? And so that's what we're going to try to do today is cut through a lot of that complexity and really try to understand the heart, the core of the Old Testament law. And one of the interesting things is that even the New Testament itself gives us a bit of a starting point. I mean, if you think about Paul in Romans or Peter in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 16, they both point out that the law, it wasn't just a list of rules. Like, it was a revelation. It was meant to reveal sin itself and the profound holiness of God. Like, that's huge. It's getting at the very nature of God.
Yeah, so right away, that's kind of a different spin than just like, oh, it's just a bunch of like old rules, do's and don'ts. It's like, no, it's actually showing us something like fundamental about God's character. And so, yeah, I mean, I think if you kind of skip over some of those books that maybe feel a little heavier, like Leviticus, you really are missing a core piece of who God is, the holiness of God.
You're missing the holiness of God. You're
Yeah.
exactly right. And so it's a twofold thing, right? Like the law, it regulates behavior,
Yeah.
yes, but it also reveals God.
Right.
And then when we look at the big picture purpose of it all, I mean, Jesus in Luke chapter 24, Paul in Galatians 3:2 through 24 are clear that the law was meant as a guide for Israel. It was meant to lead them to the Messiah. Paul even uses this great word picture. He calls the law a guardian or a pedagogos, which is like a tutor who is carefully guiding a child to their intended goal, which in this case is Christ. So there's this built-in like directionality to the law.
Yeah, that's a really helpful picture. It's like it's this guide and the destination is Christ. But I mean, we also know that it wasn't the end in and of itself, right? Like the book of Hebrews actually talks about the limitations of the law, that it couldn't ultimately like perfect our relationship with God, right?
Yeah, that's a critical point. I mean, if the whole Old Testament system of priests and sacrifices, if that was able to really perfect things, why would we need a new kind of priest, like one in the order of Melchizedek, which the book of Hebrews clarifies is the order that Jesus belongs to? He's not from the line of Aaron, the traditional Levitical line. And so the writer of Hebrews, he emphasizes that Jesus, he offered a far superior sacrifice, and he established a better covenant altogether. So the Old Testament law had this vital purpose, but it also has these inherent limitations in achieving ultimate reconciliation.
Yeah, so it reveals God, it points to Christ. But it can't ultimately bridge that gap between us and God. And so I think that raises the question then, well, why should we today as believers spend time like trying to even understand it, right? If it had that limitation.
It's a good question. And this is where that key New Testament passage comes in, 2 Timothy 3:16. Paul reminds us that all scripture, and that includes the Old Testament law, it's breathed out by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, and for training in righteousness. So even though it doesn't save us, it holds this immense value for us. And so, does the law teach us about God? It absolutely does.
Okay, so let's unpack that a little bit. What specific things about God can we learn from the law? What doctrines are kind of like embedded there in the law?
I mean, you think about some of these. I mean, the law is very clear on God's sovereignty, his absolute authority, his control over all things. You see that in Exodus chapter 34. I think so often we get caught up in verses 6 and 7 where God reveals his grace and mercy. But if you look at verse 9, Moses is actually pleading with God to go with them and pardon their sin. And so what you see there is this sense that God has the ultimate say. And then, like we already touched on, I mean, the central theme of Leviticus is God's holiness. That's woven through every single detail of the book. And then God's eternality, you see that in Deuteronomy. God's personal nature, you see that right from the very beginning in Genesis chapter 1. His his all-powerfulness, his wisdom. I mean, you see this in places like Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 10, Exodus 31. And so the very fabric of the law is revealing these core truths about who God is.
Yeah, it's so easy, I think, to get lost in like all of the rules and miss those like foundational truths about God himself.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you mentioned, I mean, you said it earlier, but like his graciousness and mercy. Yeah. I mean, that's so beautifully stated in Exodus 34:6-7.
Oh, absolutely. When you read those verses, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin. Man, that really gives you a glimpse into the heart of God.
It does. It does. And you mentioned the word forgiveness, and that is so central to the whole biblical story.
Yeah.
How does the Old Testament law introduce that idea?
Yeah, well, the sacrificial system that we see outlined in the law, especially in Leviticus, it really unveils this essential doctrine of forgiveness through what we call substitutionary sacrifice.
Okay.
The whole underlying principle is that sin, it carries the consequence of death. And that's not just a New Testament idea. It's there from the beginning.
Right.
And so what the sacrifices did was they provided a substitute, right? So an animal's life was offered in the place of the sinner. Mm-hmm. And so Leviticus 4:2-6 says that through this process, the priest would make atonement for the people and they shall be forgiven. So you see this foundational idea of a substitute taking the punishment for sin in the place of the guilty party.
So this concept of a substitute, like paying the price, that's huge.
Just massive.
But again, as we discussed, like it wasn't the final solution, right?
That's right. I mean, these sacrifices, they had to be offered repeatedly. And of course, the most significant day in the Jewish calendar for this was Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement.
Right.
And the writer of Hebrews, he really emphasizes this recurring need, that it was always pointing forward to something more. And that points to the fact that the Mosaic Covenant was always intended as a stepping stone to the ultimate, the once-for-all sacrifice of Christ. Mm-hmm. So, yes, the law teaches us about forgiveness through a substitute. But it also points forward to the fact that was temporary. It wasn't the ultimate answer. We needed something permanent.
Right. Okay, so the law reveals God's character. It reveals this concept of forgiveness. What about, you know, how we're supposed to treat each other? Does the law offer any guidance about how to live righteously, you know, in our relationships with one another?
It does. It absolutely does. And, you know, one of the common misunderstandings is that the idea of, you know, love your neighbor, that's solely a New Testament command.
Yeah.
But if you actually go back to the Old Testament, you see that Jesus himself quoted Leviticus 19:18. He said, "You shall not take vengeance or bear grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself." So this core principle of treating others with love and respect, it's deeply rooted in the Old Testament law. It shows a real continuity in God's moral expectation.
Yeah, that's such a powerful reminder that central teaching of Jesus is not something new. It's something that's rooted in the Old Testament.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. Are there other examples in the law, just kind of like morally, how we're supposed to treat one another?
Absolutely. I mean, the Ten Commandments themselves provide this foundational moral guidance, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you think about the prohibition against coveting, you know, desiring what belongs to others. Paul reflected on that command, and he actually saw that it revealed the depth of his own sinfulness.
Yeah.
And here's one that I think is maybe a little bit surprising. The idea of caring for those who serve God, that's rooted in the Old Testament law.
Really?
The priests, they benefited from certain portions of the sacrifices. And so it established this principle that those who are dedicated to God's service, they should be supported.
Interesting.
And so that gives you a little bit of a different perspective on this whole idea that spiritual leaders should, you know, live in poverty. That's not necessarily what we see in the Old Testament.
Right.
It's quite the opposite, at least in some cases.
Right. That's a really interesting angle on that.
And yeah.
So, I mean, when we, you know, think about Christians and the law.
Yeah.
There's often this phrase that we hear, you know, we're under grace, not under law.
Yeah.
Can you clarify that a little bit? Like, what does that practically mean for us?
Yeah, yeah. This is so important. And I think one of the things that's really important to understand is that being free from the Mosaic law as a means of salvation does not mean we're free to just live however we want.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, without any regard for righteousness.
Right.
And so Jesus is really clear about this in the Sermon on the Mount. He didn't lower God's standards. In fact, he intensified them.
Right.
He really emphasized the spirit behind the law.
Yeah, he took it even deeper.
He took it even deeper.
You know, it's like anger in your heart is like murder.
That's right.
Lustful thoughts, like adultery.
Yeah. It's tart.
So when we say Christians are not under the law, what specific things are we no longer bound by?
Yeah. So specifically, we're not under the specific regulations of the Mosaic Covenant as the basis for our salvation.
Mm.
So you're not, you know, going to be excluded from God's presence for getting a tattoo, even though that was prohibited in the Old Testament.
Right.
You know, we have the freedom to eat foods that were once restricted.
Yeah.
And so the core message is that our acceptance by God, it isn't earned through following these particular Mosaic rules.
Right.
However, the fundamental moral principles of God, like things like the prohibition against adultery, those things are still consistent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have the ceremonial laws, like the sacrificial system. Those were fulfilled in Christ.
Right.
The civic laws that were specifically given to ancient Israel.
Right.
Those aren't binding on us in the same way.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. It's not a license to just sin, but it's a shift in how we relate to God.
Yes.
Which, you know, specific rules apply. And you mentioned earlier Galatians and Hebrews. How do those books kind of illustrate this shift, like, away from the Mosaic law?
Yeah. The situations in Galatia and among the Hebrew Christians, they really highlight the danger of reverting to Mosaic regulations as if they were necessary for salvation or spiritual growth.
Right.
And so Paul really strongly opposed this idea that you needed Jesus plus circumcision.
Right.
To be truly saved. And the writer of Hebrews, he powerfully argued for the superiority of the new covenant established mm-hmm. through Christ. He warned against turning back to the shadows when we now have the substance in Jesus.
Right.
And so I think those books really emphasize the fulfilled nature of the old covenant in Christ.
Right.
And the new reality that we live in.
Yeah. So it's kind of recognizing, yeah, like the old covenant served its purpose, but now we live under this new covenant established by Jesus. And you know, Paul talks about the letter of the law versus the spirit of the law.
Yeah.
What's the difference there?
Well, the problem isn't with the law itself. It's with how it can be approached, like as a set of external rules without understanding the deeper intent. And so, I mean, the Pharisees are kind of the prime example of this.
Yeah.
They meticulously followed the outward requirements.
Right. The letter.
The letter of the law. But they missed the inner meaning and purpose, the spirit of the law.
Yeah.
And that led to legalism.
Right.
And a lack of true righteousness. And so Paul, in 2 Corinthians chapter 3, he contrasts the old covenant, which focused on the written code, the letter that brings death, because we can never fulfill the demands perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
He contrasts that with the new covenant, which is empowered by the Spirit and brings life.
Yeah, so it's not about, you know, ignoring the rules, but it's understanding that deeper meaning.
That's right.
And applying them through that lens of love and the Spirit.
Yeah, through the Spirit.
Yeah. Can you give some examples from like the Ten Commandments, like how that might look?
Absolutely. I mean, take the command, you shall not commit adultery. Simply keeping the letter of that law might mean just avoiding physical infidelity, right?
Right.
But the spirit of that law goes so much deeper.
Right.
It encompasses how we treat all people
mm-hmm.
with honor and respect as those created in God's image.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, you shall not murder. That's not just about physically taking a life.
Mm.
It extends to not damaging someone's reputation, not harming their well-being through lies or harmful words.
Right.
And so you can keep the letter of that law while completely violating the spirit of it.
Right.
Yeah.
That's good. That really helps it to see the importance of understanding the heart behind those commands.
Absolutely.
Now let's talk about the word Torah.
Yeah.
Because I think there's some confusion about what that even means. It seems like it has more than one meaning in the Old Testament. Is that right?
You're exactly right. Yeah. I mean, the Hebrew word Torah, it isn't just a direct equivalent of our English word law. It can also be translated as instruction or teaching. And sometimes it refers to God's standards for how we should live, you know, practical guidelines. And it even includes things like sacrifices, Sabbaths, feasts. Now, of course, for Christians under the new covenant, we aren't obligated to observe those Old Testament feasts in the same way.
Right.
But understanding their origins, like the Passover
mm-hmm.
in Exodus 12.
Yeah.
and its profound connection to Christ as our ultimate Passover lamb, that's crucial for understanding the New Testament.
Yeah.
You know, the same thing applies to all those regulations about clean and unclean.
Right.
They're not binding on us, but they give us these valuable insights into God's concern for holiness, for being set apart. And it's interesting because, like our source mentions, you know, sometimes there are these more legalistic approaches that will selectively kind of emphasize certain Old Testament regulations, like specific Sabbath rules or practices after childbirth. But then they're ignoring the broader understanding that these ceremonial laws aren't in effect for believers anymore.
Right.
And even something like the consecration of the firstborn in the Old Testament, that finds a different expression in Christian practices like baby dedications.
Right.
You know, it's not exactly the same thing.
Yeah. So Torah is really, it's much broader than just law.
Yeah.
It's encompassing kind of a whole range of God's guidance and teaching, and it can even refer to larger sections of the Old Testament. Is that right?
Absolutely. Sometimes Torah refers specifically to the book of Deuteronomy.
Okay.
Which, you know, our source knows was frequently referenced by the prophets as like the book of the law of mm-hmm. Moses.
Mm-hmm.
You see this in the books of Joshua and 2 Kings.
Okay.
Other times it can encompass the entire Pentateuch. First five books of the Bible. You see that in Ezra 7:10, where Ezra sets his heart to study all the law.
Mm-hmm.
And in a more general sense, it can simply mean instruction regarding God's will, as you see illustrated in Genesis 26 and Exodus 12.
Okay, yeah, that helps to kind of to give us some different ways that term is used.
Yeah.
Now, our source also mentions that scholars often divide the Old Testament law into kind of two main types.
That's right.
Can you explain that?
Yeah. So scholars commonly categorize the law as either casuistic or apodictic.
Okay.
And so apodictic law, that refers primarily to direct commands.
Huh.
The most prominent example being the Ten Commandments.
Okay.
So these are characterized by their straightforward you shall or you shall not structure.
Right.
And they present these general principles. Often they're addressed directly to the individual, you know, you shall not.
Right.
And the consequences for disobedience, they aren't always explicitly stated. And so you can think of them as kind of these foundational principles.
So Ten Commandments, classic example of apodictic law.
That's right.
Very clear, like do this, don't do this kind of a thing.
Exactly, exactly.
What then is casuistic law?
Casuistic law, this is what we often think of as kind of like case law, right?
Okay.
So it typically follows an if-then structure.
Okay.
And it presents these specific scenarios. They're often described in the third person.
Okay.
Like if someone's ox.
Right.
Does this, then this. And these laws often include explanations of the reasoning behind the rule.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they explicitly state the consequences for different actions.
Right.
So a great example of this is Deuteronomy 15:7-10,
okay,
which deals with lending to the poor. And what it does is it lays out the specific situation.
Mm-hmm.
It explains why you shouldn't be hard-hearted.
Right.
It even mentions the blessings that come from being generous.
Mm.
So it's about applying these broader principles
mm-hmm.
to these specific real-life situations.
Okay. That's really helpful, kind of having that detailed example.
Yeah.
So apodictic is like the general principle, and then casuistic is like applying it to all these different situations.
Exactly. That's a great way to put it.
Yeah. Okay. Now, when we read about obedience in the Old Testament, how should we understand its role? Was it about earning God's favor or salvation?
And our source stresses this, that obedience to the Mosaic Law wasn't a prerequisite for salvation, but rather a response of gratitude from those who had already been chosen by God.
Mm-hmm.
Just as in the New Testament, salvation in the Old Testament was by grace through faith.
Mm-hmm.
And so Exodus 19 is a really great illustration of this. God declares Israel to be his segula, his treasured possession, before he even gives them the law. And so verse 5 says, "Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples." And then even the very beginning of the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20:2, you know, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery."
Yeah.
It's not, "I will be if you obey."
Right.
It's, "I am your God," based on the saving act.
Yeah, that's a That's a really crucial distinction, I think, to grasp.
Yeah.
So obedience wasn't the way to become God's people, but it was the way for God's people to live in relationship with him.
Yes, exactly. And so obedience was an expression of that covenant relationship between Yahweh and Israel. And so instead of just seeing the law as this, you know, list of demands, our source encourages us to think of it as a love letter from God to his chosen people. And so while obedience wasn't the basis for their salvation, it was a condition for them to fulfill their mission as a nation.
Okay.
And to experience God's promised blessings. And that's outlined really clearly in Deuteronomy 28.
Yeah.
But it's really important not to directly transfer that dynamic of like national blessing for obedience onto the individual believer under the new covenant.
Right.
Like the nature of the covenants is different.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. So if obedience wasn't about earning salvation, what was the point of God giving Israel this intricate system of laws?
Yeah. Well, one of the key aspects was privilege. You know, God's law, it set Israel apart from all these surrounding nations who worshiped these powerless idols.
Right.
And Psalm 115, it powerfully contrasts the living God of Israel with these lifeless man-made idols.
Right.
And so true obedience, it was meant to be this outward demonstration of an inward faith and love for God. And, you know, Jesus' own words about loving him and keeping his commandments echo this very idea. You know, think about it like a marriage. You know, love for your spouse, it leads to a desire to honor them, to respect the boundaries of the covenant that you've made.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Love is the motivating factor for obedience, not the other way around.
That's right.
Right? When it comes to our standing before God.
That's right.
Yeah. And our source mentioned the Old Testament scholar Chris Wright.
Yes.
And how he categorizes the law into five types.
Yeah.
Can you kind of briefly explain those?
Yeah. So he proposes dividing the law into criminal law, civil law, family law, cultic law, which deals with worship, and then compassionate law.
Okay.
Now, not every scholar agrees with this exact division, but it is a helpful framework for understanding the different spheres that the Mosaic law addressed. So, for example, you know, some of the rather severe civic laws regarding rebellious sons.
Right.
I mean, that highlights how different the societal structures were back then.
Yeah.
And why those specific laws don't apply today in the same way. On the other hand, you know, compassionate laws, like those requiring care for the poor and vulnerable, they reveal these timeless moral principles that Jesus himself affirmed by quoting Leviticus.
Yeah. So some parts were very specific to ancient Israel's like social and political context.
That's right.
And then others are kind of revealing these more enduring ethical principles.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah. And another point that our source addresses is this misconception that the law was like impossible to understand and obey.
Yeah.
Is that accurate?
No. No, not at all. The laws were given in a way that was understandable for the people of Israel. And while obedience wasn't always perfect, I mean, scripture makes that clear, it was presented as achievable.
Right.
And crucially, God also provided these mechanisms for forgiveness, both for unintentional mistakes and even for willful sins. And that demonstrates his understanding of human frailty. And his desire for reconciliation.
Yeah, that's such a key point that God wasn't setting them up for inevitable failure.
Yeah.
Without a way to be restored.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that brings us to, I think, the core question, at least for those of us who are, you know, living in this New Testament era.
Yeah.
Like, are we required to live according to the Mosaic law?
This is where a lot of confusion can arise.
Right.
And so let's take the example of the prohibition against tattoos in Leviticus.
Okay.
So to understand this, we need to consider the historical context. You know, tattoos back then, they were often associated with pagan mourning rituals or marking allegiance to false gods.
Right.
And so the motivation of the heart is key here.
Right.
And then, you know, our source mentions the practical consideration of permanence. But ultimately, your salvation and standing with God do not depend on whether or not you have a tattoo.
Right. So it comes back to understanding like the principle behind it, the original context.
Yes.
Rather than just like the literal command.
Exactly. You're exactly right. And so there is this relationship of both continuity and discontinuity between the Old and New Covenants.
Okay.
And so some laws are explicitly renewed or reinforced in the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
Some are no longer applicable because they were tied to that old covenant system.
Right.
And then some, like those core moral principles,
mm-hmm.
those remain. And so, you know, we see the ceremonial laws, like the sacrificial system, those are no longer binding.
Right.
But the moral laws against things like adultery, premarital sex, homosexual behavior, those are consistently upheld.
Right.
And as we've discussed, you know, Jesus often raised the bar in terms of the spirit of the law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how have theologians throughout history kind of understood this complex relationship between the Old Testament law and believers today?
Yeah. It's a complex issue. And our source actually outlines five different approaches, kind of theological approaches to this.
Yeah.
So maybe we can just kind of give a quick overview of each of these.
Yeah, that'd be great.
So first, you have the Theonomic Reformed view.
Okay.
And this perspective, they believe that civil laws in society today should actually align with those judicial laws given in the Old Testament.
Okay.
Exclu-